Welcome, welcome. Phoenix Suns podcast here on Bright Side of the Sun, episode 33. 33 is a fun number here out in Phoenix. That's Alvin Adams, Ring of Honor member. Grant Hill, just cherished member of the Suns for the few years he was here. Ryan McDonough, our general manager, is 33, which makes me put some perspective on what I'm doing with my life. And, you know, one short of Charles Barkley. And I say one short of Charles Barkley because the number one is going to be relevant here in a lot of what we're going to talk about in terms of all the fun news going on in the Valley. Chris Habas, as always, Jim Kochenour doing this. We're the best two-man, three-man weave in the business on the podcast. Jim, how are you doing? Very, very busy day here on Tuesday. Folks are listening to this on Wednesday, but really busy day in the Valley here today.
It's been a great day in the Valley. I think the high was actually only 86 today, and most of the day was in the 70s with a nice little drizzle. And for those of you who don't live in Phoenix, a high of 86 in August is about as rare as you can get. That type of weather doesn't hit here very often. But like you mentioned, like you alluded to, it's been a pretty busy news cycle here in Phoenix. There was a bunch of breaking news today, some highly anticipated stuff, and I think that it's been kind of going over the news outlets, and that was the release of the 2013-2014 NBA schedule.
Yeah, and the number one, as I alluded to, is the number one is the true amount of national TV games the Phoenix Suns have. You may look at the schedule and go, Chris, they play four games on NBA TV and one game on ESPN. They have five national TV games. I don't really count NBA TV as national TV. It's a special channel. You know, for some folks, it's not on every single package. And they have the opportunity to flex out the Suns if they want to. If a game's better, they can just bring that game on if they really wanted to. So one true national TV game against the New Orleans Pelicans. Sorry, you don't have to adjust your audio. I scream Pelicans and I write it in all caps still. Schedule comes out, Jim. As I mentioned, one true national TV game, five in general. I mean, an NBA schedule, in my opinion, is all about like who plays on Christmas and getting excited about those kind of things. But it's 82 games always. It's four games against divisional opponents, three against other opponents, at least two against the East. It's always the same thing. They just jumble up the order and the teams get better and worse each year. What did you think about the schedule? What are your thoughts on it as it releases yesterday?
It's not always necessarily as much of a mixed bag as you kind of referenced there. Because last year, for instance, with the Phoenix Suns, they had a pretty easy schedule to start off. And I think that gave some people some false hope that the team wouldn't be quite as bad as it ended up being. If you remember, they played home against Detroit, at Orlando, and at Charlotte in their first five games. They actually had another game against Cleveland that was still kind of finding their way at that point. A bunch of easy games early in that schedule, and they racked up a couple wins. They beat Detroit, beat Charlotte, beat Cleveland, and people had a little bit of hope that the team might not be quite as bad. It turned out that a bunch of those teams were the worst teams in the NBA. And even further down the schedule in that first month where the teams, you're not quite sure where everybody kind of stands, then they went out and got that savage beating at the hands of the Pistons, which I actually found myself laughing during the fourth quarter of that game because it was just completely out of hand and we were getting embarrassed. And I guess, you know, that's part of my pinnacle behavior, my perverse sense of joy, my schadenfreude. But so that kind of, you know, changed the dynamic of that season. So it was a little different in terms of the way the game stacked up. But to be honest, the first thing that I was looking for as soon as I popped open the schedule and that new schedule smell came out was, where do the Suns have the potential to go on some big losing streaks? So that was my first take on the schedule, was kind of pouring through there, perusing it to see where the Suns were going to fall on their face.
Yeah, and I did the same thing, kind of looking at it and seeing where the shortcomings are going to be with the really, really big and tough months. Now, looking at the schedule from that angle, let's go with just the amount of games against playoff teams. And each month, they have a fair share because, you know, there's 16 playoff teams, so you're going to play a lot of these playoff teams, obviously. But in November, they only play five playoff teams with two of them on the road, and they only have three back-to-backs in general. So, like, that's actually technically, when you look at it, the easiest month of the season for the Phoenix Suns, which, as you mentioned, you alluded to, that this year's schedule to start off is actually tougher than last year's. And last year, the Suns, the best they could start was 4-4. That's the best record they had the entire season. So, Jim, I know you're looking at it. I'm looking at it as well. Real quick sidebar question. Looking at the first 10 games of the season, because the first 10 games of the season last year, the Suns had 5 winnable games and then 5 games against playoff teams. They started off 4-6. When you look at the first 10 games of the season, starting off at home against Portland, and then the last game in that 10-game stretch is at Sacramento, I'm looking at it, and there's a really good chance that the Phoenix Suns only win about 2 to 3 games in that stretch, because they do play a handful of playoff teams. So what is the best record you think they can have in the first 10 games of the year, being as positive as possible?
3-7.
3-7. And that's as positive as possible. You're not straddling a line or being negative Jim, right?
No, that's 3-7 to me seems utterly realistic.
I tend to agree. I mean, when you look at it, I mean, yeah, Portland is probably, I mean, yeah, they did make the playoffs last year, but they're dramatically improved and a nice young core. Utah is a team that everyone thinks is tanking, but I actually look at their roster and think that that's a team that can win games against bad teams, at least. I don't think they're in that bottom 5 of the league. I think they're more in that, like, 7 to 13 range. And then obviously you have Oklahoma City, New Orleans, San Antonio, Denver as a murderer's row for the next 4 games. And then New Orleans at home, Portland again in a return game, Brooklyn Nets with Jason Kidd coming to town as the head coach, Sacramento. So, I mean, with those, I mean, right there, I can see them beating Sacramento, maybe steal one from the Pelicans, and then get one from Portland, Utah. Is that kind of what you're looking at?
That's what I see. They're playing a couple of the wrong teams on the road there. I think they have a chance against New Orleans at home. That should be a game that they should be neck and neck in there. But even at the end there, the at Sacramento game, I would count that as a loss. So the first 2 games, I think they could split Portland and Utah. They'll have some energy coming out of the gate in front of the home crowd, season starting. So I could see them splitting that. And then as you go down the line there, it's going to be a little bit tougher. So even if they start out 1-1, then 2-6 sounds like a pretty likely record for the remaining games there to start off the season.
Yeah, that's pretty tough. Because like I said, last year, 4-6 in the first 10, if you're looking at it for a clean number 10. But the best they got all season was 4-4, and partially due to the detrimental 7-game losing streak early on in the season. That was just, I mean, demoralizing, deflating. The team couldn't recover from it. And, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, they're not the most talented team in the league last year. So, you know, if you lose 7 in a row, it's not the end of your season, but it's deflating enough to be the beginning of the end of your season early on, even though it's an 82-game marathon. So to switch gears and continue, December, they play 10 playoff teams, 6 of them on the road, with 3 back-to-back sets in that stretch. I think that's to look at the months between December and January. Between December and January, they play 20 former playoff teams. 11 of those games are on the road with 7 total back-to-back sets. That's a stretch right there between December and January that, with all things considered, if all 16 playoff teams from last year are competitive to better than Phoenix at least, and by all things accounted for, they should be based on talent, that could be just a real, real tough stretch between December and January, and we just started them off 3-7 between, you know, the beginning of November.
Yeah, there's no soft spots in the schedule for a team as bad as the Suns, and the fan base, I think, for the most part, at least the educated fan base, I think a lot of our listeners, the people on Brightside, consist a lot of that educated fan base. We're pretty dedicated, borderline obsessive fans. Maybe some of us not even borderline. I probably fall into the obsessive portion of that faction. But when you're going to be most likely a bottom 5 team, maybe if things go better and some things click and things work out better, maybe you're only a bottom 10 team. I personally can't really see them rising above like 7 or 8, maybe best case scenario at this point. There aren't easy games. There are even bottom feeder teams, when you're playing them at home, those are still potential losses. So there's no soft underbelly to the schedule. Everything's going to be tough. And when you go through some of these tough stretches of games, they can be completely demoralizing, just like the Suns had that going on last year, because you're going to take some really truculent beatings. You're going to take some savage beatings at the hands of some of these better teams with the youth and inexperience on the team. When things start to snowball and get out of control, then there is a propensity for these games to get really ugly. Likewise, like the team showed last year, if the team can play well and kind of stick around to the end of the game, then that'll build confidence for the young people. But you're going to have a lot more lopsided losses than close games where you have a chance to win in the fourth.
Yeah, I agree. That's a really valid, solid point that I think a lot of people need to consider, is that when you're a rebuilding team, when you're a team that's, you know, not as talented as the 16 playoff teams and some teams that improved this offseason, they added some talent. It's a more dynamic, more interesting group, in my opinion. I think they're more athletic, obviously. They're going to be probably a little bit funner to watch, while at the same time pretty infuriating, because a lot of times when you have young athletes, you got a lot of guys that don't know how to play the game as well as maybe some seasoned non-athletic guys. So it's going to be one of those things where it's going to be really fun to watch them sometimes. It's going to be really frustrating because they're very young, very athletic, but lacking skill in certain parts of the game that's going to make the game tough. And when you look at the schedule, you know, you have a total of six sets of at least three-game road trips. So six sets. You have four trio, or I don't think there's an actual term for it, but four times this season where they go on the road for at least a three-game road trip, and one time a four-game road trip, and then another time a five-game road trip, which for beat writers out there, I apologize for you guys having to be on the road so much, because the Suns only in turn have four streaks at home of at least three games in a row at home. So I don't know who to talk to. Do we talk to Adam Silver or who you got to talk to? But four sets of at least three games in a row at home versus six sets on the road feels a little bit intense there. The Suns are definitely going to have a real tough go of it. You know, a lot of their road games are clustered together. A lot of them are against good teams. And every single road trip that I just mentioned, of the six, only one of them are against teams out here on the West Coast. So it's going to be basically five long road trips out east, at least east of Minnesota, for five of the six road trips. So it's going to be a real interesting go of it on the road. It's going to be real tough for this team to win a lot of games on the road based on the way their road games are clustered.
They do have one good stretch at home during the season where they might have a chance to kiss their babies and do some laundry. And that is, they play Golden State at home, Miami at home, and then that leads into the All-Star break. So after they get on the plane after the Houston game on February 5th, they'll be back in Phoenix on the 6th, and their next road game isn't until the 18th at Denver. And since we don't need to worry about having any of the Suns probably participate in a ton of All-Star activities, then I think that's, you know, almost 2 weeks where they're going to get to have some downtime, some family time, and hopefully it'll give them a chance to recharge and maybe even get some practice time, depending on how things go.
Yeah.
The other big takeaway that I had from the schedule was the way it wraps up. And they played 9 of the 13 last games on the road. And after they have a little bit of an easier stretch, you got some teams like Boston, Toronto, Orlando, Detroit that aren't world beaters ahead of that. But then they go into that, and I could easily see that turning into a complete disaster to end the season, and then posting a 2-11, 3-10 type of record down the stretch. And even potentially, it wouldn't shock me for them to be riding on a 12-game losing streak, similar to last year where they had that horrible losing streak at the end of the season, going into that last game at Sacramento. And even that's not a gimme the way we're looking at it now, gauging it. And things might turn out a little bit differently. There's always some risers and fallers, so we can't prognosticate everything perfectly, but that looks like it has the propensity to get really ugly. That's really bad potential, bad juju at the end of the season.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And when you look at that, take it a step further, it's 14 of the final 21. So you mentioned 9 of 13, but also 14 of the final 21 games are on the road. And when you start picking and choosing those games and looking at them, at Boston, at Toronto, which I think is going to be dramatically worse this year. Actually, I started putting together their roster, and they spent all offseason getting point guards and forgot that there's five positions on the court. And then you know, at Minnesota, who's a team you want to see succeed, at Washington, who could be good or bad, at New Orleans, at Dallas, at Sacramento. So the reason I mention all those games is a lot of those are against their peers, And when I say the Suns' peers, I mean teams that are in the bottom seven of the NBA, potentially vying for higher lottery odds. And, you know, you don't go into games trying to lose, but when you go into a game against, for example, the Sacramento Kings, and the difference between you guys is one game and being a lottery team in the top three versus, you know, sliding into the top four or five, that's actually a more important game than, you know, when the Lakers come to town, for example. So it'll get real interesting late in the season there. And to continue on your point real quick, I don't want to go too long into this, but so they come back from Houston on the 6th, as you mentioned, of February, and then have that long stretch of basically 11, 12 days where they're at home. Here's the good thing about that is that they've been building assets, right? They've been putting together a roster of pretty favorable-looking pieces. Ryan McDonough's going to be sitting in his own desk in his own office for basically 12 days, and you saw what he's able to do in the past 3 months basically as a general manager between the draft and trades. Imagine what that guy's going to be able to do, being able to sit at his own desk in comfort, kick his feet up, and make phone calls. There's a chance that a lot of those guys that go and visit their family after the game against the Miami Heat on the 11th potentially don't make it back to Phoenix if the team is wheeling and dealing during the season like they were in the offseason. Which, I don't know if you did this on purpose, Jim, but speaking of transactions, players maybe not returning, good news with the schedule. Bad news with one of the Phoenix Suns in the news. I don't know if you did this on purpose, but I think you said the word "hi" about 16 times in your opening sentence or two. Was there a point to that, or was that just beautifully pun intended?
You know, I think that was completely coincidental.
Very organic.
I'm not sure even what you're referencing right now, so maybe you can fill me in on why you think that I was being tendentious with my previous statements.
Yeah, you know what? If all those were organic, then kudos to you. You're a little bit smarter than I even give you credit for. And guys, I think Jim's pretty smart. Michael Beasley in the news again. We've seen from his track record a lot of unfortunate incidents that happened with Miami and with Minnesota, and then comes over to Phoenix and has the traffic issue in January where he's, you know, it's not an issue to have a gun. I guess it's actually, I don't know the gun laws, but I know Arizona's a little bit more lenient than other states, but pulled over going about 30 plus miles over the speed limit in a 45 and happened to have a loaded gun in the car. That happens in January. And then in May, he's accused, or, you know, fingers are pointed at him with sexual assault. And then now we have, you know, yesterday being Tuesday, Michael Beasley is arrested and, you know, everything's still pending. I don't know what's official and what's not official, but another drug possession charge, you know, pulled over. Drugs were found in the car, marijuana specifically. And Michael Beasley is once again, unfortunately, in the news. And the three-year contract, the three-year experiment of bringing over Michael Beasley, it feels like we're in year five of that three-year contract, and we just wrapped up year one, Jim. And it's a lot of it is because Michael Beasley's been in the news, and none of it's been positive.
I'll preface this by saying that when the Suns originally signed Michael Beasley, that I thought it was a fairly good calculated gamble on a risk-reward situation because I didn't think there was a ton of risk. The contract wasn't something that could blow up on the team and be completely detrimental. It wasn't a possible albatross. It was 3 years, $18 million. The last year was only half guaranteed. So even if things went south, it wasn't like it would be a burden on the team, a huge burden that would stunt the ability for the team to grow from that point. But like you just mentioned before you passed it over to me, it seems like he's been on this team a long time now. And part of that was his completely putrid play during the season. And then the rest of it is these last three incidents in the last 8 months, less than 8 months. And I've been saying since the season ended that I'm in favor of waiving Michael Beasley. I don't want him around the young players. I don't want him influencing the young players. I wouldn't want him around my kids. And so I don't see why the Suns would want him around their kids. And that was before any of this happened. The joke was that if the Suns were wanting to tank, then they could keep Beasley and keep him on the court, and that should help that strategy. But I joked that I would only be in favor of that if they put his locker room in the parking garage, because I just don't want him around the young players. I don't want that kind of influence. And I'm not saying that Beasley is necessarily this horrible guy, that he's this stone-cold criminal or anything like that. I don't know him that well personally to see what he's doing behind the scenes at all times. But from what I have seen with all this, I think that the experiment just needs to end. In terms of him personally, I think he's kind of aloof. He's kind of a goofy guy. And I don't have a problem with the fact that he's just, and it's a pot-related charge, marijuana. I know people that smoke marijuana. I don't think it's a big deal. I think it should be legalized. I don't think there's any stigma associated with that. I'm of the opinion that alcohol is worse than marijuana. Not a lot of people smoke pot and beat their wives. There isn't a lot of that same type of stuff that goes on. Alcoholism causes a lot more damage in terms of health care and deaths. I don't see marijuana as that big of an issue. But what it does show is just this pattern of terrible judgment, inability to develop as a player. While I don't have a problem with the marijuana, he knows it's against the rules. He's in a job where it's against the rules, so you follow the rules. That's what he's chosen to do. If you want to go Ricky Williams and don't want to obey the rules, then you need to step away and find a different career path. And so I think that this gives the son the perfect opportunity to cut ways. Ever since the drug scandal in the 80s, the Suns have had close to a zero-tolerance method of dealing with players when there were troubled situations. And guess what? This is a drug-involved situation, and Beasley has a pattern of this. So I think that it's probably time for the Michael Beasley, Phoenix Suns marriage to come to an end, that it's time to divorce themselves of each other.
Yeah, and you make the Ricky Williams correlation. If he decided to step away from basketball today and just not play again, he'd still collect his contract. You know, if he just decided to not be a member of the Suns, if he quits, he quits. You know, he won't get the money. But, you know, if the Suns decide to waive him or cut him, he'll have made roughly $35 million in his overall NBA career, roughly $35 million, because next year is a fully guaranteed $6 million. The following year could be, you know, just a partial $3 million. So, you know, he's made a lot of money. He's had three chances. Here, two things with Michael Beasley. The first one is that his first issue, his first, you know, trouble that came around that was, you know, involved with drugs, was at the NBA rookie transitional program. Before he played an NBA game, before he was a full-fledged member of the NBA, he's in trouble because a party going on with him, Mario Chalmers, and Darrell Arthur turns the smoke alarm off, and police have to come to the room. They smell marijuana. Michael Beasley reportedly beats feet and gets out of there. And no one would have been the wiser, apparently, if Pat Riley didn't make him confess and then tell him to go forward. So his first issues happened before an NBA game was even played, and yet he still got 2 years out of Miami, still got 2 years out of Minnesota, got a full season out of the Suns, and, you know, unless they waive him, cut him, stretch him, whatever they do, you know, he's still got two more years of NBA money coming to him and potentially two more years of being able to play basketball if the Suns keep him. That's the first point. The second point goes to what you're talking about with character and personality. Michael Beasley reminds me just almost to a T of that elite high school basketball player. We all played with him. I'm sure, Jim, you can think back to high school. All the listeners, think back to when you're in high school and you have that one of the best players on your high school team. But he's probably the guy that doesn't get any scholarships, doesn't make it to college, you know, is probably still in his hometown hanging out with the crew and doing whatever. Michael Beasley made it to the next step. He got to college. He got to Kansas State. He dominated there as well, made it to the NBA, lasted a handful of years. But he just reminds me so much of that guy because he's a guy that is immensely talented, but just makes bad decisions. You don't necessarily love to play with him because he's a black hole when he gets the ball, but he's the best player on the playground. And when Beasley wants to be, he can be the best player on an NBA court every now and then. That's kind of my correlation with him, is that he's not super fun to play with, but he's not a bad guy. He makes a lot of bad decisions, but he's kind of just a goofy 24, 25-year-old kid. And that's part of what gets forgotten about it. He's still a 24, 25-year-old kid, not making excuses for him because I'm 26 and I don't have any of the seven issues that Michael Beasley has had in his so far career in the NBA. So, you know, he's 24. He makes tons of bad decisions. He's made it 5 years in the NBA. We'll see how much longer he has in the NBA. I mean, here's the question for you, Jim. Short answer or long. Does he get a fourth chance in the NBA? Let's say the Suns part ways with him, whether it's now, next year, whenever. Does he get a fourth chance in the NBA? Does another team take a chance on him?
I think he'll get another chance. And forgive my previous harangue, my diatribe, where I was going into this in depth. But I don't know if it'll be directly after this. Maybe some team signs him to a one-year type of deal. I could see him playing foreign ball somewhere. That's where I think he could get a fit there and get a chance to kind of redeem himself. I have a hard time seeing a team after this. There's always one, though. But just like the Suns did, you see that talent and you think, you know, we're going to be the one to get him, and we're going to be the one to change him, and we're going to be the one to put him through this palingenesis. He's going to be the, you know, the phoenix, just like the Phoenix Suns. He's going to be that mythical creature where he's going to be born again here. And I think actually you might have found something where you saw somebody speaking along those lines in regard to Michael Beasley, maybe in the not too distant past.
Yeah, I mean, and I did an interview with Lon Babbie last year. I happened to be able to corral him and talk to him for a couple of minutes in the Suns corridors after a practice. I think it was in the midst of that 7-game losing streak we talked about. And, you know, Lon spoke about a 3-year experiment. He spoke directly to this is something that they knew going in was going to be tough, wasn't going to be easy, that they hope everything pays off with their efforts on him, and they were only 20 games into a 3-year project. Well, now you're 82 games into a 3-year project, but more importantly than 82 games and 3-year project is the three notable potential run-ins with the law that all could end in, you know, negative things for Michael Beasley: the speeding charge in January, sexual assault in May, and then you have the marijuana stuff here in August. So it's like every 3 months or so it rears its ugly head. With all his other teams, he had 2 strikes and he was out. Miami, 2 strikes, and they're like, traded you. Pat Riley's like, I can't fix you. David Kahn thought he could. After 2 strikes with Minnesota, they don't renew his rookie contract. We can't fix you. Somebody else can. Lance Blanks and crew go, we can fix him. We bring him in. And now 1 year into it, it's almost like the regression is a little bit quicker everywhere he goes. It doesn't really happen at Kansas State. It happens. It takes about 2 years or so to happen in Miami. It takes about a year and a half or so to happen in Minnesota. And it only took a year here in Phoenix. So that's a little tough. It's hard, you know, that had to be where everything had to go. But yeah, when Michael Beasley came in, Lance Blanks and Alvin Gentry and Lon Babbie, one of the main things they were most consistent about whenever I talked to them was Michael Beasley is a kid that we want to change. We want to mentor him. We want to help him. We want to guide him. We want to, you know, it's deeper than basketball with him. You know, we want to make him, you know, a good individual. We want to help him along the way. 82 games into the season, this is a business at the end of the day. I mean, and 2/3 of that equation that I just mentioned aren't even in the office anymore. I just don't see how they can keep him in hand. And as you mentioned, all it takes is one team to like him. David Kahn thought he could change him. Lance Blanks thought he can change him. And I guarantee you this without, I would bet my house and everything on it. If there was someone named Derrick Rose still on the board, the Miami Heat would not have drafted Michael Beasley. Pat Riley was very, very vocal about the fact that he didn't want Beasley and he'd rather have Derrick Rose. They got the number 2 pick. They ended up with Beasley. He stuck him out for 2 years, then got rid of him. Once he was able to find a team, Minnesota, David Kahn, that was willing to take him. So, yeah, you know, everyone thinks they can fix him. Like you said, everyone thinks that he's someone that they can fix and someone they can change, and they can tap that talent and be the one that finally brought it out of him and kind of turn him into the next Carmelo Anthony type player. But it just never happened. And, you know, we'll see if that happens going forward. Now, to switch gears, I mentioned 2/3 of the front office is gone and, you know, Lon Babbie remains, but the next 2 guys that came in to replace Lance Blanks and Alvin Gentry respectively are Ryan McDonough and Jeff Hornacek. You and I were able to sit down with each of them individually, you with Coach Hornacek, myself with General Manager McDonough, and we're able to talk about a lot of different things. And I'm really interested, actually, in your conversation, because mine was more nuts and bolts and logistical, and it seems like you had a very, very kind of flowy conversation, a very Phoenix Suns fan conversation with Jeff Hornacek, talking about memories past. So what were some of the highlights of that conversation and some of the stuff that maybe you didn't get a chance to write on that was a highlight to you?
yeah, segueing away to something a little bit more positive.
I would never do that.
To two guys that have absolutely no ties to the last person that we were just speaking about. And, yeah, I think a lot of the Suns fans can kind of feel the new energy that the team has gone on a paradigm shift from the last season and some of the incompetence people felt within the front office at that point, that things just weren't getting done, that there wasn't progress being made, and now people seem to be really optimistic about the way things are trending forward, and I am. I think that things are definitely headed in the right direction. And, yeah, I did have a little bit of just a more casual conversation, like you said, with Jeff, and we went through a lot of stuff, and I detailed a lot of that through the stories, but what people can't hear, empathize with, feel in terms of some of the stuff there, and I pointed out, was that some of the emotion that Jeff had when we were talking, and the way I sensed it, at least, and I can't speak for exactly how Coach Hornacek was feeling while we were talking about this stuff, but he seemed genuinely affected a lot of the time while he was talking, especially about his time with the Suns and the ties there, that he seemed disappointed, like remorseful, not, I guess remorseful, that's probably the wrong word, but like very deflated about the way things had turned out about his departure. He joked about it with the whole way Barkley thing had gone, but I really think that when he was here before, when he was younger, that he really felt he was part of something special, and he was still new into the NBA, and I don't think it was as big of a business as it was today, and you saw team players stick with teams back then, that it wasn't this strange freak occurrence for a player to actually stay with a team for a long time or play his entire career there. Tom Chambers was the first free agent, and that was right when Hornacek was starting his career. So I really felt that he thought he was part of something special with that Phoenix Suns team, and that he thought he was going to stay there and continue to play with those teammates. And that wasn't the way it worked out. And it seems like he still has a really strong tie here in Phoenix, that he used the word we, and I emphasized that in the article, to where it almost feels like he never felt that he was away from this. This is where he started off, and now he's back, and it's the return of a player that was invested in this team before to a team, and he's still invested in it. And talking with him, I just can't imagine a more storybook type of scenario than him finally coming back to Phoenix and being able to achieve winning that championship that they fell just short of, and that he sounded convicted about the fact that he really thought that team was that close, that they were right there on the cusp of achieving that before during his playing time.
Yeah, so it almost sounds like when Ryan McDonough, Lon Babby, Robert Sarver, everyone that was probably at least in a way involved in hiring Jeff Hornacek, a lot of people were up in the air and their arms were up in the air with Dan Majerle not really getting a fair shake during the season, and Dan Marley's the former Sun, lovable local guy. Well, it seems like they got that covered with Jeff Hornacek, and then people also, you know, they were kind of upset with Alvin Gentry leaving, that player's coach that everyone really seemed to like. They seemed like they got that covered with Jeff Hornacek, and everyone wanted to see a fresh new face. You know, Jeff is, I'm pretty sure he'll admit to not being a spring chicken, but, you know, they wanted that fresh young coach, a guy that doesn't have a lot of experience, but, you know, can step in, a former assistant. They got that covered with Jeff too. So, you know, it seems like they checked a lot of things off the list from a PR, basketball, every kind of way you can look at it standpoint, bringing on Jeff. And I'm super excited. I, like I said, like you mentioned, the energy, definitely feel it when you're around. I know the team's not gonna be good for the next couple of years, but it just feels like everything's moving in the right direction. It never truly felt like that with the previous regime. There was some modest excitement here and there with different little things, but it never truly felt like, oh, they brought back the hometown guy who used to play here, and, you know, assistant that's younger, has ties to the team, is charismatic and funny. Like, they got that guy, they brought him in. Things feel like they're moving in the right direction. And speaking of direction, the one thing that I didn't really get a chance to go in depth with writing, with talking to Ryan McDonough, is draft philosophy. I'm a draft guy. I know I mention that every now and then. It's not to toot a horn. It's just that's just kind of what I do. But in terms of like the draft, I got a chance to talk to him about draft philosophy and kind of, you know, what teams should do drafting like in 2013, but projecting and looking at the 2014 draft. And one of the really cool things was mentioned, he mentioned that not rated 1 through 100, but every position and, you know, rated how they felt they were in that position with all the guys they thought they would be first round picks in the 2014 draft. They had that board up next to the 2013 draft, and it might have been a slip. It felt like probably the only like real genuine moment from Ryan. Ryan was genuine with me, but it felt like very genuine when he had mentioned that part of why they drafted Alex Len was in part because looking at that 2014 board, they felt that Alex Len was a guy that you could probably couple with someone in 2014 and start to create something, kind of something I alluded to with an article on how they should draft a center. So, you know, I liked how he talked about that a little bit, mentioned they had the 2014 board up. I'm sure every team did. And, you know, just talking about how the draft process, you got to be looking at future free agency. You got to be looking at current free agency. You got to be looking at next year's draft. Nothing can be right now. He's not a big fan of drafting the best available player at a position you need. He'd much rather take the best available player because a lot of teams end up, you know, hurting themselves by taking the best available small forward when you need a small forward, even though he might be the 7th rated player on the board, and instead of drafting the number 1 rated player and just adding talent to your roster. So I know he's mentioned that a few times in different things, saying he likes to draft the best available player, but I thought that was a nice little insight into the 2013 war room, that they're looking at a board that says Wiggins, Parker, Randall, Exum, Smart. They're looking at all those guys amongst probably 26 other names, and they drafted Alex Len and Archie Goodwin because they felt those two guys meshed well with a future pairing of the 2014 picks in free agency. So I thought that was some nice insight and so a real good look at the way teams drafting, specifically the Suns drafting.
Okay, question for you, Chris. I don't know how much time you've had to talk with Jeff Hornacek, and I've only had a little bit of time to talk with Ryan McDonough. I got to speak with him for a little bit in Las Vegas at the Summer League and go over a couple things with him. But to you, here's my take, and then maybe you can just give your take instead of responding to my, you know, response or question directly, that McDonough reminds me of a person who's got like the gears spinning in his head at all time, that there's like a bunch of activity, buzzing, electricity going on in there, that he's very calculated and just has a lot of stuff going on up there. While as Hornacek seems like a much more fluid type of thinker, where he's got more of a natural take on things, where it just kind of comes naturally. But he's not that calculated type of guy. Do you see that kind of dynamic, or what's your take between the two guys? How do you kind of view them that way?
You know what? I'm glad you mentioned it that way and the way you described it, because that's basically the same way I would describe it with my own Chris words. But yeah, I mean, Ryan McDonough, and I mean this in the most positive way. It's not meant to sound insulting, but like when you talk to Ryan McDonough, he's such a good speaker. And he's so well thought out, and you can tell that, you know, his gears are always spinning, so he's probably thought of these questions and how to answer them. Every question I've ever thought of, plus 50,000 other ones that I'm not smart enough to think of. But he definitely feels like it's almost like you asked him a question and you gave him 30 minutes to send you a concise email reply. That's kind of what it felt like when you talked to Ryan McDonough. But all the answers were natural. Like I said, I was able to catch him off guard with a couple of things. He showed a lot of personality when I mentioned that the Celtics between 04 and 07 lost 144 games. He actually stopped me mid-question and goes, wait, what? They did? Why would you tell me that? And like, he laughed it off and actually showed a lot of personality there when I was talking about the Celtics rebuild and how it took 3 years and a lot of losses and a lot of planning and meticulous things to make that work. So I definitely think there's a personality in there, and I think it's going to take a little bit of time for him to be more natural showing it. And it's, you know, it's going to take him getting used to us and the fans and the city a little more. He's only been here for a few months, but completely agree with your description. He seems very, very, a little bit more calculated, a little bit more concise with his responses. He knows what he wants to say to questions, and he's genuine when he answers them, but he's just so well spoken that it almost sounds like he had 30 minutes to prepare the answer for a question you asked him 2 seconds ago.
Yeah, that's the way that I look at it, is just that McDonough's more of the academic variety and Hornacek's got a little bit more feel. And I know that when I talked with Ryan, that he's told me that despite what I kind of see there in terms of that academic calculated type of personality, that he makes his judgments first off of the field. But it just seems like it's conveyed and comes across more from Hornacek when I talk to him. It just seems that, I don't know whether it's some of the experience from his career or anything, when I talk to him, everything just kind of is natural and flows forth. So it just a little bit different personality there, and I think it's really refreshing. And not take anything away from Alvin Gentry at all, because actually the way that Jeff spoke with me, I think was a little bit similar to the way Alvin handled the media, and especially in close quarters, where he was just really relaxed and kind of laid back, and you could talk to him before the game, and he'd be kind of like kicking back in his chair. And so compared to his replacement, the interim coach, Lindsey Hunter, who was completely terrible to speak with, and then Lance Blanks, who you were lucky if you could find to speak with, I think that the way that they're going to deal with the fans, the media, everything is going to be a lot better for the team moving forward.
Yeah, and you know what? I think that's a nice dynamic. It's when you have, you mentioned, if you want to kind of label them as the intellect, the scholar type with Ryan McDonough, and again, not an insult on Jeff. I'm not saying he's not an educated guy. But you have, it's almost like that typical tandem that you see that makes, you know, movies good or makes, you know, buddy comedies funny, where you have one guy who's a certain type of personality and another guy that's a different type of personality, but they click and they get chemistry and their two different sides are able to work together. One more creative and flowy, one a little bit more like nuts and bolts. And I think that that's I really do like that dynamic. And I think that if Lon Babbie is able to kind of step back in the shadows and Robert Sarver steps back in the shadows a little bit and lets these guys do their thing, I think the Suns might have something special. I think they might have a tandem that can kind of hang out here in Phoenix for decades to come if they truly want to be that group and has a chance to do something real special here. But I'm not saying win a championship. There's a lot of great teams and great players out there, but I definitely think they have something special going forward.
I agree. I can see, and it's not going to be overnight either. I don't want to try to stoke people's enthusiasm and hopes here that there's going to be some huge Pedroyant change here in the near future, and things are just going to swing around, and by next season the Suns are going to be a 55 win team or anything like that. But I do see a lot of positive things from talking with both of these people, a lot more positive than I saw at the end of the season with who was in place. And like I mentioned, it was a paradigm shift in my opinion, and things were going spiraling downward. And now I see them ascending from that nadir, and hopefully the Suns are headed to the zenith and acme and ready to join their normal place atop the top of the league in the discussion among those elite teams, those teams that have a chance at contending for a title.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I just want to point one thing out. I had some bright side readers out there attacking me for an autocorrect mess up in my thing, in my article on Peasley that went up on Tuesday. It was an autocorrect issue, guys. I didn't use the wrong word in the sentence, and they said I was trying to be a fake Jim by using big words and using them in the wrong context. I was killed by autocorrect, folks. I apologize for that. It happens every now and then, but Jim is definitely the wordsmith. He's the noted thesaurus of Bright Side of the Sun. I try to just ride his coattails, basically, and try and be in the same league as him every now and then.
Well, you don't necessarily have to be in the same league, on the same planet is probably close enough. We're definitely on the same, not on the same court. But I think it works out well, because just like we talked about the difference in the dynamic between McDonough and Hornacek, I'd say I'm like kind of the Ryan and you're the Jeff. And so we got the Ryan and Jeff. Maybe we should rename this the Ryan and Jeff Show, because I think we have that same type of dynamic and also the chemistry. I think that the chemistry is really important, and that's probably something that they're actually probably trying to mimic, is that the great chemistry that we've built together, and hopefully they can build that kind of chemistry this season to emulate us.
Exactly. And if we can tap into that dynamic, and you know, we'll call it the McDonough and Hornacek Show, or I'm sure you guys out there in the Bright Side universe can create a much better, more creative name for that. But it'll become the McDonough and Hornacek Show as soon as we get those guys on. And that's definitely something that we're working towards. We'll with the news today, it was just us talking. But looking forward to having some special guests. I have one lined up here for this month. And hopefully this week, if we can make it work out. And then, you know, leading up to training camp, we'll definitely have, you know, the coaching staff, the players, general manager, et cetera. We'll get these guys on the podcast and let you guys be able to kind of hear from them and get more out of them than just what you hear on 620 in those 5-minute quick segments. We'll try and get them on the podcast to talk more in depth with us. But I'm glad we're able to go long, Jim. There was two definitive subjects we had to talk about. We prepared diligently for them, and then Michael Beasley got arrested. So we decided to run long for you guys, give you guys a full packed schedule update and breakout and the release on the schedule, talk some Beasley, talk some Hornacek and McDonough, since we were lucky enough to have a few moments with those guys. Definitely appreciate them taking some time out of their day and sitting back and talking to us folks here at Brightside. But that's a wrap. You know, I definitely appreciate you guys listening. Jim, do you have any wise words, any parting shots for the Brightsiders?
I think we got some other promises from some people to come on the show. The way the Suns like to break news, I have really high hopes that we'll have more news coming out maybe next Tuesday, a couple hours before we go on this adventure together again.
Yeah, we do that, right? We seem to record podcasts on the exact right date. Guys, the Wednesday decision was the best decision this podcast has ever made, because Suns news happens every Tuesday, and we greatly appreciate you guys staying within the confines of our recording schedule, breaking the news so that way we're not a week behind talking about stuff. Well, for that guy, Jim Kokenauer, Chris Habis, this is episode 33. Thanks for listening. Share, tell a friend, to all your, share on Facebook, throw it up on Twitter. Tell the people that you know that like the Suns that may not know about the site about Brightside and the podcast, and we'll be back with you guys next week.